Let's try that again. Good afternoon, everyone.
Afternoon.
Perfect. I want you guys to go back in time with me, back to August 1st, 2012. We all work for a company called Knight Capital Group. We've all gathered together for a viewing party of the opening of the New York Stock Exchange. We've invited our friends, our family, stakeholders, and product owners to come and celebrate the opening of the New York Stock Exchange, because the software that we just deployed, the software that we just wrote, is actually going to start trading stocks in the New York Stock Exchange. We're so excited that we've actually written the app that's running behind me that is going to track in real time exactly how much money we're going to start making as soon as our product goes live in the market. So let's just sit back, enjoy the food, and let's just start counting the money. I'm going to let that sink in for a second, because we are losing $170,000 per second. $170,000 per second is being lost every time our software is running. Clearly, this is not what we came here to celebrate. So the devs and the ops, they hop into action, and they go in and they try to figure out what in the world is going on. We deployed our software to 8 servers, of which we identify one of them as doing the wrong thing. So what do? We try to fix it. So we go in and we start rolling things back manually to get it back to where it was before. After we're done fixing it, we have 8 machines doing the wrong thing, losing even more than $170,000 per second. So clearly, what do? You keep trying to fix it. They kept trying to fix it for 45 minutes, okay? Losing $170,000 per second. After running for just 1 minute, we had already lost $10 million. Eventually, 45 minutes later, someone just runs into the room and just starts kicking over servers, pulling cables out of the wall, just stop the software from trading. When the dust settled, they had lost $460 million. $500 million in 45 minutes because a poor guy read a manual on how to deploy software and did it right 7 out of 8 times. He messed up once, and messing up one time on their deployment cost them their business and $500 million. So my question to you is, what would be the impact to your organization? Are you the poor guy wearing the pager when you do a deployment? Are you one of the team of guys up all night long every time it's a deployment, all hands on deck, code freeze? This is the world that they lived in as well, and they'd done it right 7 out of 8 times. And with the tools that I'm going to show you today, they could have saved this company, well, $500 million. So is what I'm talking to you about important? It's $500 million important, okay, depending on your company. Now that I have your attention, my name is Donovan Brown. I am a senior program manager for DevOps at Microsoft. If it's DevOps and it relates to TFS or VSO, it is now my responsibility. I blog all the time on this. I just blogged last night on what the definition of DevOps was. I have another extremely popular blog post on why DevOps is hot right now. I'm surprised on how many times that gets picked up and retweeted again, but I'm very proud of it. I also have a YouTube technical channel. That's funny, this is an old slide, because I also tweet at Donovan Brown. A lot of you guys found me already. As you can see, I'm very competitive, and a friend of mine, Jeffrey Snover, you might know him, he's the inventor of PowerShell. Back at Build, he said, hey, I just reached 10,000 followers. I was like, man, I want 10,000 followers. Now, this room is packed to the gills right now, and if everyone in this room follows me, I probably only need about 9,000 more. So do your part, and please follow me on Twitter, at Donovan Brown, and I will not answer any questions from you unless I can see that you are a follower of mine, so I would get to it right now. All right, I happen to be one of the best air hockey players in the planet, right? So I am number 12 in the world. If we can find an air hockey table anywhere in New Zealand, I can annihilate everyone in the room. And so do you, that air hockey at the professional level is like anything else at a professional level. It's intense. It's not what you see at your Chuck E. Cheese or your kids screaming and hitting it hard. It's really cool. And you can actually go to my YouTube channel there and just look for Pro Table Sports. You'll see a lot of cool videos there. I drive an M3. I actually wore my jacket today, so lots of championships. I'm actually really good at that too, so I'm really, really competitive. And like I said in my last talk, I'm going to bring that competitive nature to Microsoft when it comes to being the best at DevOps we possibly can be. Okay. So what are we going to get out of this session? Very similar to the last one with an exception. You see where it says demo? Last time it was a tour. This time you are actually going to see that stuff in flight. This is hands down the riskiest demo I have ever done. I thought while I was in New Zealand that this demo would be the scariest thing I did, but then my girlfriend got the idea she wants to jump off a Sky Tower tomorrow morning. So now that's probably going to be the scariest thing I do while I'm in New Zealand. But I'm very proud of this demo. We are actually going to put Release Management Team Foundation Server through its paces. We're going to be deploying the new preview ASP.NET 5 application on top of MVC 6 to a Docker container running in Linux in Azure. We're going to test it with XUnit. We're also going to test it with Selenium. And I will take you guys very slowly through all of that stuff. So you'll see exactly how I was able to configure it and how our tools can take you to where you want to go. So why DevOps and why DevOps now? I just had a customer meeting in between my sessions, and one of them said, so define DevOps, and I did, based on what I told you guys last time. It's the union of people, process, and products to enable continuous delivery of value to our end users. That, to me, is the best definition I can come up with for what DevOps is. But why DevOps now? Why not 5 years from now? Why not 5 years ago? Why is DevOps so hot right now? And I believe the reason that DevOps is so hot now is because it is what hurts the most right now. Historically, deploying software was the last thing on our mind because we couldn't even write software well, right? We were always late. We were always over budget, right? And it cost over budget, out of date, and it didn't do but half of what we wanted it to do to begin with, right? So the problem that hurt most historically was our inability to even write good software. So what did we do? We came up with Scrum, Agile. We came up with extreme programming, pairing, test-driven development, you name it. And what did that allow us to do? That allowed half of this story to become better. Our development pipeline was now producing value at an accelerated rate. I'm very particular there. It was producing value. We weren't delivering that value to anyone because we had this wall in between us of automation, or lack of automation. We had these people that were trying to protect it. So it was very complex to deploy our software. Why is it so complex? Because it hurt to deploy our software. So we thought, I have a great idea. Since it hurts and it's risky, let's only do it once a year. Well, think about that. So instead of having lots of little changes, we have a year's worth of changes all rushing into production at the exact same time. What are the chances that some of that's going to go wrong? And now I have no idea what over the last year actually caused us to break. But if you actually reverse that thinking and say, if I deploy these features more readily, more often, when something breaks, it's easy to roll back, and I know exactly what was broken, right? It's not this spaghetti of information that I have to get through. It's very error-prone. As the story I told when we first started said, the guy did it right 7 out of the 8 times, but he made a mistake on the 8th server that cost his company everything. And it's chaotic. You've been there in the middle of the night, right? You're up till 3 o'clock in the morning, the whole team's there. You guys are tired. You're running off of coffee. You're trembling at the keyboard because of the adrenaline and all of the caffeine. And I'm supposed to go in and make a change to a web.config in a production server. And then I leave off an angle bracket. I leave off a quote. I do something careless, and the next thing you know, yellow screen of death. So what do we want to do? We clearly want to get rid of all this and just automate that center part. And what we're going to do is we're going to automate it using the tools that I have here today. That's the end of the slides. This is what we're about to go do. Okay? So I am about to use, that's not even all the technology I'm using in this demo. That's just all I could make sense of in the cloud that I was trying to build to give you an idea of what it is that we're going to go off and try to do. If you would like to play along, that's the URL you need. I'm so proud of this demo, I actually went and registered a domain name for it. I didn't want you to have to type those big, long, giant Azure names. Have you guys deployed something to Azure and you looked at that enormous name? You couldn't type that in there. So go to peopletracker.us, and it's a simple MVC application currently running inside of a Docker container where you can actually list your name. And I'd be quick because I'm going to show that page, but I'm not going to scroll, so only the first 25 people are going to get recorded and be forever at Ignite. But the point of you doing that is that I'm going to change the schema of the database while I'm up here on stage with you and not drop a single line of data and also not write a single line of SQL to do so. I'm going to let the tools do that for me, including release management. Now, this I thought was impressive, but if I were to run the demo right now, you guys would be like, yeah, it worked. But I don't think you understand exactly what's going on. So I've created this little bouncing ball to explain to you exactly what we're about to go do, because it's going to happen kind of quick. It's amazing how efficient our tools are. But the first thing that's going to happen, I'm going to use Git, for those who like Git, and I'm going to do a commit. That commit actually, we're going to do a couple other things, because I'm actually going to go and do a real workflow where I actually create a branch, commit to the branch, and I'll show you how to do a pull request. That pull request will then go ahead and go through my review process, and then it will trigger another build that will actually trigger the release. So there's a couple more things in that commit that I showed here. Once that commit happens, we're then going to trigger a build. That build is going to go down to our agent. I stood up my own agent because I had a lot of cool stuff I wanted to do with that agent. I wanted to make sure it had the right browsers on it because I'm going to be running Selenium test, once against Firefox, once against Chrome, so that you guys can see that we can actually run our app against different browsers. During our build, we're going to compile the code. We're going to test the code using XUnit, right? Not using MS Test. Again, this is the new Microsoft that plays nice with others. So I'm going to be using XUnit versus our own MS Test just to prove that we can. You could be happily use NUnit or MBUnit or whatever type of unit you want to use here. We're then going to go and publish that information, and then we're going to package it up. We're going to build an image. I'm a big fan of build once, deploy many times. You don't want to build it every time you deploy it, because every time you build it, you add additional risk. But when we're dealing with Docker, what you're actually building is what we call an image. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to build that image, and then I'm going to push that image over to Docker Hub. Imagine Docker Hub is like GitHub for Docker images. It's this big repository where you can go and download images that have the applications in it that you want. Because I don't want to have to build this for my dev, my QA, and my production environments. I take that application or that image once it's built, and I put it over into Docker Hub. I label it with the build number that just produced that image. Because I could have multiple pipelines running at once. And I don't want the latest version of the Docker image per se. I want the version of the Docker image that goes with the build that I'm trying to deploy. So I actually tag it, and I can show you Docker and how it tags my images so that when I go through my pipeline, I can say, yes, I want you to go get this image, but this specific version of that image. And on the website, it shows you what version of the image is actually running so that we can verify that. I then package additional artifacts that are going to be used by my release system once we get into releasing. So that's what happened during our build. We got the latest, we compiled it, we tested it, we packaged our image, we shipped it off to Docker Hub, and now our build is complete. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to release that code. Over here I have times three because I have a Docker host for dev, a Docker host for QA, and a Docker host for production. And what I'm going to do is deploy the same image to all three of those hosts. But when I do that, where they point has to be different. I was telling a story right before we started. The image inside of Docker right now is using Mono. Mono does not allow you to connect to Azure SQL because Azure SQL requires encryption. And Mono currently does not support encryption. So how do I do my database connections? So what I did is I decided I'm going to stand up on that web API server, a simple ASP.NET web API, that can access my Azure SQL server, and then have my Docker talk to that web API to do all of its CRUD operations on the database. Right? So it made it a little bit more complicated, but it allowed me to use ASP.NET and Mono to still do my CRUD application. Now, the interesting part there is that even though I only build the image once, each image is pointing at a completely different web server so that it gets the database from dev or QA or production. And I'll show you how I was able to do that. It's actually pretty neat how that was able to work. And obviously, I have three SQL servers as well. So I'm going to deploy the database using DACPAC. I will talk to you really quickly. We're going to go look at the solution that I have inside of my system here, and I'll talk to you about SSDT. How many of you are familiar with SSDT? Oh, quite a few of you. That's more than normal, right? Most people have no idea what I'm talking about. It is SQL Server Data Tools. If you are using SQL Server and you do not know what SSDT is, you need to go search for SSDT right now. I'd recommend Bing because we pay you to search. So if you didn't know that already, I got a lot of Amazon gift cards because I search with Bing. So I would go check that out. Then I'm going to deploy my web API. And then finally, I'm going to go run my Docker image on that particular host. And then finally, I'm going to run some additional tests. So this is where I've deployed everything. And now I want Selenium to wake up, go use Firefox in one environment, and then go use Chrome in another environment to prove that it works against all the different IDEs, or the different browsers, excuse me. And then finally, we're going to sit here and wait for an approval. We're going to say, now that we've done that successfully in dev, would you like me to repeat this entire process in QA? One thing that I do differently in QA is I also run load test. Now, what I'm showing you is proof of concept, not a best practice. A best practice when building a DevOps pipeline is to do the exact same thing in every single stage. That way, by the time you get to production, you've done this dozens, if not hundreds of times, and I know for a fact it's going to work in production, right? So you want to do the same deployments. The two things that we change in a pipeline are scale and configuration. What I mean by that is when I deploy to dev, it might be deploying to one box where I have my database and my apps tier all on one machine. When I go to QA, I might actually have my database on one machine and my web server on another machine. But what I do to the web server and what I do to the database server is exactly the same. So it's the scale that's changing. And when I go to production, it's 10 web servers and 10 database servers to sustain our load. But what I do to the database servers and what I do to the web servers, again, is exactly the same, right? So I usually don't add and remove different steps throughout my pipeline. But on a demo like this, I want to show you everything that you possibly can do. So we're going to throw in a load test just for fun as well. So are you guys ready to see this?
Yep.
No. I worked really hard on this demo. I want everyone at Ignite to know just how badly you guys want to see this. So I'm going to ask you one more time, are you guys ready to see this?
Yeah!
Oh, perfect, because I'm ready to show it to you. This is going to be a lot of fun. Like I said, it's going to be cool if it works or doesn't work. It's going to be an amazing explosion. I actually put this on GitHub the last time I did a similar demo to this one. People asked me, hey, Donovan, can you share the code with us? So I said, sure. So there's a GitHub repo that you can go to, and my name there is Dark Warrior. It's my gamer tag from Xbox. And I'll bring that up so we can see it in the background. But you can actually go there and download the code that is this particular application if you want to try it at home. The links here under applications uses, these are actually all the technology that I'm actually using in this demo. I'm not bluffing. This is a lot of moving parts here. But it really drives home the fact that I don't care what you have, we have ways for us to build it, package it, and deploy it for you using this tool. This is the application, right? This is People Tracker. And if you guys have already started playing with it, I should be able to see some people's names over here. Great. So you are the famous ones, right? So everyone here now will be on his video forever. And what I am going to do is I'm going to actually add a middle name column. As I said in the first talk, I'm a huge agilist, big, big fan of Scrum. At the end of every sprint, we basically go into a dog and pony show of this is the cool stuff that we created last sprint. So let's pretend we're in that meeting right now, and I'm showing this application to our stakeholders and our end users. And I would show them that the application actually works. And then I would be able to come over here and say create new, and let's just go ahead and add myself here. Donovan. I can't type all of a sudden. I am not going to misspell my own name. That's a big pet peeve of mine when people misspell my name. It's not two A's, it's two O's. So down at the bottom, now that I have to scroll to get my own self back on there, you can see that everything works. So the product owner says, great start, guys. I like this. But like all good product owners, as soon as he sees it, he wants to change it, right? I need middle name. Because if you had two Donovan Browns up here, how would I distinguish one Donovan Brown from the other Donovan Brown? Valid point. So let's go back in and add the middle name. So what is that actually going to entail? I have to change my image. That's going to be deployed to Docker. I also have to change the schema of my database. I have to add that column that has middle name in it. And I can't lose any of the data that's already in here. I'll show you how I do that without actually writing a single line of SQL. So now that we know the app we're going to be looking at, and I have three versions of this app. If we were to go back to the homepage, a couple of things I want to point out to you. Down here, this 293 that's at the bottom, that 293 is the version of the image that we're running on this particular Docker host. And that's going to change to probably 294 or 295, some other higher number, depending on how many other builds I'd done since the last time I ran this demo. That's actually going to deploy here, so we'll actually see that value change. The value next to it, this big long URL, this is the URL to the web service that this version is pointing to. That did not work like I wanted it to. But I actually have one for dev, and I have one for QA, and I have one for prod here. As you can see, the end of it changes. And that's what we're also going to be having to change. So this information changes per image. But the image is the exact same image. And I'll show you how I was able to achieve that with ASP.NET 5. It's actually pretty cool how that worked. So let's go and let's look at our solution. So this is our solution. And what I've been talking to you guys about is this little magical guy right here. SSDT. If you have Visual Studio, you already have this, you just didn't know you already have it. Anyone familiar with Redgate? It's the same tools or similar tools, schema comparison, version control, data comparison, same things you have there inside Visual Studio, sitting there ready for you to use. One difference is we work with SQL Server, they work with other stuff besides SQL Server. But I version the schema of my database alongside the application in which it supports. So now when I want to deploy my database, I just build this particular project. And when I build this project, there creates something called a DACPack file. The best way to describe a DACPack, it's like the digital fingerprint of the schema of my database. And what I can do is I can give you or give this tool this particular DACPAC file, and I can say, and there's my database over there. Please go update that database to look like this schema, but don't lose any of the data. And it will go figure out all the alter scripts and alter tables necessary to do that for me without actually changing any of the data or losing any of the data, which is very, very powerful. Another thing that's nice about this is it allows me to do things like refactoring. If I wanted to rename a column, I can go into SSMS today, go to a database, rename a column, and save it. Know what it'll do? It'll save it. What will happen when I run a stored procedure that has the old spelling of that column in it? It'll blow chunks. And SSMS will not tell me a thing about it. This tool, on the other hand, if I were to change the name of a column and then build this project, it will tell me you just broke all of these stored procedures. Either go fix them or rename that file back the way it was before, right? So it protects you from making mistakes that you would only find otherwise at runtime. Very, very powerful stuff. In here, I also have my Selenium test. So if you come here for my UI test, I could have just as well used my coded UI, one of my pet projects at Microsoft. So we have a solution that does this, but we also want to prove that we work with other people as well. And Selenium is an extremely popular framework. I highly recommend people look at it because it does great when you want to do truly cross-platform, when you want to go to Safari on a Mac and run your test, or you want to run it against Linux and something else. So Selenium can actually get you there, and I'll show you how we run our test here as well. But this is just a normal coded UI test project like anything else. I added the appropriate NuGet packages, and now all I have to do is add it to my build, and my build system will run it for me, and actually run the test for me as well. Okay. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to do a good Git citizen, and from what I understand, I come from TFVC. We have this thing called a gated build, which protects my builds from ever being broken. They don't have that inside of Git. So what they do in Git, or so I'm told, because again, I am not a Git guy, is that you create a branch for whatever you want to do, you push that branch up to a repository, and then you issue a pull request. And that pull request allows someone to review what it is that you want to change and then bring it into their branch as well. And I want to show that we support Git inside of Visual Studio, not only inside of the IDE, where I'm more comfortable, but also from the command line. So I'm going to switch back and forth just so that you can see it's real Git. It's not Microsoft's flavor of Git. It's real Git, and you can use the tools you know and love today to work with repositories, even if they're stored inside of VSO. We also allow you to work directly with GitHub. So if you really wanted to take the GitHub repo that I just showed you, fork it inside of your own GitHub project, you can then do continuous delivery from your GitHub repo inside of our tool set as well, right? So just to let you know, it's that powerful. So what I'm going to do here real quick is I'm going to go ahead and create a new branch. And in this branch, I'm going to do add middle name. And let's go ahead and create this branch. Now what I want to do is I want to make sure that I publish this branch up to VSO so that I have a target here for where I can do my pull request and things like that. So at this point, hopefully everything got pushed up to where it's supposed to be. Yep, perfect. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to come down here to a command prompt, and I'm just going to do a git status, just so that you can see this is real git. And now what I'm going to do is I'm going to do the fastest programming ever. I'm going to go make all the changes necessary. All right, I'm done. So all I did is I copied files from another location, right? Fastest programming you've ever seen in your life. But if I now do a git status again, you'll see that I have changes, right? I didn't want you guys to see me have to type. I've done all the cooking already. But now what I'm going to do is I'm going to check these things in. I could do a git push from command line, but I just wanted to show you command tools or our tools. Do whatever you want. You feel comfortable. I'm more comfortable here. So what I'm going to do is to say I added the middle name. And I'm going to commit and push this to VSO. Perfect. I should be pushing here. Great, successfully pushed to our repo. So now I'm going to go back up inside of Visual Studio. I'm going to go over to our code, and we'll be able to see those changes that I just made here. Now, nothing has actually started moving, right? Because once I commit this pull request, that's when the CI kicks off, the build kicks off, the release kicks off, Docker happens, the whole nine yards. So that's why I wanted to show you the little bouncing ball, because if I hadn't shown you the bouncing ball, it happened so quick you wouldn't have been impressed. And hopefully you will be impressed, because there's a lot of stuff that could go wrong between now and when we actually go back to that website. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a pull request. And here I get to decide who I want to review the code, right, and what I want to have happen. We can even say, when you create a pull request, I want you to go build the code real quick in that repo and make sure it builds before you even bother the developers with doing an actual pull request. But I'm pretty confident it's going to build. Here I can see all the files I changed, so you can quickly see what it was that I modified. I modified the controller, the schema, the views to be able to have to support the middle name. So these are all the changes that I made. And I want to go ahead and say create a pull request. So now that I have a pull request created, anyone that was responsible for reviewing it would get the same view, be able to review my files, be able to review my commits, and then come over here if they wanted to and approve or deny this. When I approve this, this is now going to push into the master branch, which is going to trigger that whole little bouncing ball that I told you about. So I'm going to go ahead and complete this. And what should have happened is if I go over to our build system and I look at our queued builds, there should be a build running. Now, we've made a lot of changes to our build. First, go ahead. We can zoom in a little bit, sure. Let me do a 4 here. So this is our new build system running. And as you can see, it's scrolling the error logs, right? This is all of the text that's actually being generated by our agent. Historically, with the XAML builds, this was very hard to find. When I had a build that failed and I needed to go figure out what went wrong, getting to the logs was very, very difficult. And we've surfaced them now in real time. And this is very powerful when you're actually trying to work on a build that's brand new. And as you can see, all of my different tasks here are actually called out on the left-hand side so that you can see that I'm going to go and I'm going to run some unit tests. I'm going to run some XUnit tests, which are different, because I did use MS test against my web servers, but I use XUnit against my ASP.NET 5 application. So I actually run both types of tests during this particular one. And then I'm going to publish the results so that you'll be able to see those. And now I'm packaging that site up so that it can go over to Docker. And if you want to see how I was able to actually do that, let's go and look at the anatomy of this build. So if I go and edit this guy, over here, you can see all of the different tasks. Remember, what did I say in my last session? If you can do it from a command line, I can do it from build. See those two command line tasks in there? That's exactly what those guys are doing for me. ASP.NET 5 is so preview that our tool set doesn't know actually how to work with it yet. It's still evolving. It's still learning. But there are command lines that I can actually execute that will go package it and run the test for me. So I just told build the exact time where I need you to go and run my XUnit test, go and transform the results so that I can get the output that I want. So any tools you use today that you can show me a command line for, we would be able to do something very similar to this one and get the exact results that we want. So when this is done, it's going to now trigger a release. And that release is going to then start taking the output and actually deploying it to those different environments as well. Okay, I showed this last time. I think there might be a few people here who weren't in the other one, so I'll go ahead and bring this up again. This is a list of tasks that you have available to you out of the box. And we have tasks that range from any type of a development you can actually imagine. And you can extend this list. It's actually quite easy. You just need a PowerShell, an image, and a JSON file. The JSON file describes what you want us to do and the parameters and the inputs. The image is what we show here on the screen, and the PowerShell is what we execute when we run our task. I've written a couple of them. The way that we're deploying our DAC pack was a task that I wrote myself because I wanted it to work a very specific way. And then swapping between slots as well. Question? Is this stuff in 2015 as well or just VSO? It is in 2015 from the build side. Right? There's build and there's release. Release uses everything from build, but release will not be out yet. We're targeting the end of the year. But yes, if you were to download TFS 2015 right now, you should be able to do all of the build stuff I'm showing you. Good question. Okay, so here we have our, like I said, just a laundry list of tasks that you can actually do. Big supporter of Java. So if you have Maven, then if you have Java in your organization, don't make them afraid of .NET. Of VSO and TFS. We have value there. We have a plugin that fits inside of Eclipse, right? You can use us from IntelliJ. You can use us from the command line. You can use us wherever you want to. We'll build your Maven. We'll build your Ant. We'll run your JUnit test. We'll even publish your technical debt to SonarQube for you. So I don't want people to think it's VSO, so it only works for .NET. I was at a company, I think it was 2 weeks ago, and I said, "You guys are all .NET developers?" And they said, "Yes." I said, "Do you have any Java developers?" And they said, "Yes." I'm like, "Where are they?" Well, we didn't think they'd be interested in this. I'm like, why? They're writing software too. They need version control too. They need build and all the same things that you need. And guess what? These tools work regardless of your technology, regardless of your language, and regardless of your platform. Our agent runs on Linux, it runs on Mac, and it runs on Windows. So make sure you understand that you can consolidate your entire organization, even if they're using Power Builder and VB6, to start using Team Foundation Server and VSO to consolidate all your development. So I'm going to get out of the Zoom part. It's moving a little slow for me. And now what we're going to do is we're going to move over from the build, and we're going to start looking at release. Now, what should happen is we should have a release that's already in flight, hopefully, if everything's working the way it's supposed to. Let's see. Perfect. So 2 minutes ago, this release seems like it started. And I can come in here and I can start looking around and see exactly what's going on. It's done one of the four tasks it's supposed to be doing inside of that particular environment. If we want to see more about what's going on there, we simply click on Show More. And as we can see, it's downloaded the artifacts that I published to the server. It's gone ahead and actually deployed my DAC pack successfully. So right now, my database that is pointing for dev actually has that middle name column in it, and everyone's name should still be safe inside of there. It's then going to go back in, and it's going to deploy my web service that's going to be able to support that new schema and that new database objects. And then finally, we're going to issue a run command to Docker. Now, this is where it gets really interesting. Let me go back here real quick. I needed to read. The configuration is the biggest pain point. I have an app that has information in the web.config or config.json that needs to be different for dev than it is for QA than it is for prod. How do I change that information? Right? That's a real, real problem. ASP.NET 5 came up with a really clever way of fixing that. So I'm going to actually go and load another project here, another solution. And what we're going to do inside of this solution here, I believe it is we're going to go take a look at how I was able to solve that particular problem. We have a completely new configuration model inside of ASP.NET 5. This is the most important part right here. What we're doing here is we're saying, okay, everything is dependency injected, right? So if you don't know dependency injection, I would recommend just getting a quick primer on it, because we dependency inject everything inside of ASP.NET. And what we're saying is that we want to have a configuration builder that first looks inside of our config.json. That is a file that lives inside of my project where I have all my development settings in. Then it says, I want you to then go look inside of your environment variables. And if any of the values match, the environment variables win. So it allows me to build and actually overwrite values as I move out. So on my development machine, my environment variables are empty. I don't care about them. I'm going to use my config.json. However, on my Linux machines, on my Docker containers, I'm able to pass in additional environment variables. So when I say, I want you to go run this image, I actually pass in values that are going to overwrite what is inside my config.json. My ASP.NET app doesn't know where it's actually coming from. It just says, I need the connection string. And because I set the connection string as an environment variable on my Docker image, that's what that container actually sees. So I'm able to reuse the exact same image. I don't have to rebuild it. By just passing in additional information on my run command, I'm able to have it perform completely differently. Right? So is everyone clear on how we're doing that configuration part? Because that's a question that I asked a lot of people. I'm like, great, so I need to move from dev to QA, QA to prod. How do I do that for configuration? And all I got was, I'm sure there's a way. I'm like, no. How do I do it? Because I have a demo in 2 weeks, and I actually have to do this in front of people. I can't say, I'm sure there's a way. I need to figure this out. And this is what I was able to figure out, and it worked brilliantly. And I can show you inside of our task, if we go back to our release definition, I'm actually able to show you where I pass that additional information in. So if we were to come back over here to my web service, let's go look at our environments. And I'm going to issue my Docker run command. I actually here am actually able to pass in additional values. And these additional values that I'm passing in are what are overriding my connection string for me. It can be as many values as you want. You can even protect those values if you need through to our configuration. We have variables that you can set here and reuse throughout your entire deployment. We actually encrypt these for you as well, and they're encrypted at rest. What I mean is that if we save them to a disk, no one can go and see what those values are. They're encrypted in the flight, and they're actually encrypted at rest as well. And then you can just reuse these values inside of your definitions of your release. So it worked out really, really well for me to be able to do that. Not only can we do it for the entire configuration or deployment, we can actually set variables as well here for each individual environment. Because I need it to be different for dev than I needed to do for QA than I need it to be for production. So we allow you several different levels for you to actually set the variables in your deployment pipeline. Now, another thing that I actually set up was the ability for me to have approvers. And I actually have an approver in front of my QA environment. So what the release product has done already, because I had no approvers in dev, I wanted it to go into dev and leave dev quickly. It actually has done all that, and it is now waiting, asking the QA lead, can I please get inside of your environment and start deploying the software again? Of course, before I do that, I need to go verify that it did what it's supposed to do. And what it's doing up here is it's saying, Donovan, there is an approval or a rejection waiting for you to go back in and approve this. So what I should do first is come back over here, and let's make sure we're on our dev instance. And then I'm simply going to go over here and click on people. And as you can see, I now have a middle name column. Everyone that was there before is still there. And I actually have Firefox eUser because I used Firefox with Selenium test to go test my application after I deployed it to make sure that the middle column was working correctly. And now what we can do by simply approving this is if I go back, and you'll notice here, let me go back here real quick, this value here is different. Remember when I showed it to you earlier, it was using 293? We've actually published a new copy of our image to Docker Hub, and it's now 294, and that's the one that's deploying here. But if I were to go over here to our QA environment, then what you're going to see is this is still running 293 version of the image. And this one still only has two columns in the database. I don't know if anyone run over here. No one's over here to play. But as you can see, it only has two columns. And what I'm going to do now by simply saying everything looks good in dev is have you go and repeat this exact same process inside our QA environment. So in a moment, when I come back, I should see Chrome eUser, I think is the guy who I use for testing. And we should have a third column here. And it's going to take a little bit longer. So let me go ahead and start this while I tell you why it's going to take a little bit longer. Looks good in dev. The reason it's going to look a little bit different is because of down here. I actually decided, now that we're in QA and we're getting close to production, I want to make sure that the application is going to be able to sustain the load that we want. Inside of Azure, we have the ability to generate load on your website for you. So what I said is I'd like you to run a 60-second unit web load test, excuse me, with 25 users hitting my website as hard as you possibly can so that I can then download the results, look at them, and see if it performs the way that I want it to. And if so, then I'll finally give you the thumbs up saying it's okay to move this into production. So any level of testing that you want, manual, functional, UI automation, load test, you just tell us what you want done, we'll do it for you, and then report back the status for you as well. Now, I ran unit tests during my build. I ran a Selenium test during my release. What I like about the way our tools talk to each other is if I go back to the build itself, and I look at the anatomy of this particular build, you'll see that it has lots of different tests over here. It knows that the Selenium test that you ran in dev is actually running against this build. So it published the results of its test run against that build. So if I ever find the build, I get to see all the tests run against that build, regardless if it was run during our build, our release to dev, release to QA, or release to prod. So at one location, I can come and see the health of this particular build. Not only do I have, let me zoom in here just a little bit, not only do I have my test results, I also have my code coverage. It's pathetic right now, right? 1.25%. I wouldn't go celebrate with that. But what's interesting is 100% code coverage. Does that mean you're bug-free? Anyone believe that you are? I did. I believe that if I was 100% code coverage, I would be bug-free. And I worked on this one page of my website. I race cars for fun, and I run one of the nation's largest online registration websites for motorsports events. And I basically tested this one page till it was 100% code coverage. I was so excited. I thought, man, finally, a page that'll never have a bug on it again. Well, the last thing that my website does when it blows chunks is it sends me an email. Say, yo, Donovan, I'm going down. This is the page I was on, and this is everything that I know about why I'm about to crash. Guess what the first email was from? The page that was 100% code coverage. I was so distraught. I couldn't understand how if I had 100% code coverage, I had still had bugs on that page. All 100% code coverage means is I tested all the paths. Not that I put in negative values where it's supposed to be positive values. Not where I actually tried to break it, but I did exercise every path that you told me to with nice friendly values that you gave me to test it with, right? So 100% code coverage does not mean it's bug free. But what I do like about code coverage is whenever I run a scrum team, the DOD, or what we call the definition of done, mandates that you write unit tests for any new code that you write, period. So even if this is only 1.52, if that ever dips to 1.51, I know that someone on my team just violated that rule. So it's not the number that's terribly important, it's the movement of the number that's very, very important. And that's why we surface it here for you in our build. You immediately know whoever caused this check-in, you and I need to sit down and have a talk. Because you just broke our definition of done, because that number should do one of two things. It should stay flat or it should go up. If it does anything other, then you and I need to sit down and have a talk. Right? But anything over north of 70 is like fantastic. Right? It's a lot of work, a lot of work. And I wouldn't recommend just shooting for the number. Make sure you're doing it for a reason. We also, yeah, go ahead.
What about
smart unit tests? Smart unit tests will get you to 100% code coverage very, very quickly. And it's a great feature. I mean, if you knew PEX, it's now in the box. It's no longer experimental. We just changed the name of it. Yeah. So IntelliTest, I think, is what we're calling it, too. It's changed names like five times. But I think IntelliTest is the final name of Smart Unit Test. Yeah.
It will test the output paths.
It will. It will find really nefarious stuff. It will pass in nulls where you expect values to be and things like that. So yeah, it's a really good new feature about it. Good point. All right, so it also does things like your commits and your check-ins. It'll associate your work items to it as well. When you fix a bug, you can actually tag it such that we know exactly what commit fixed that particular bug. So your QA team can go back and say, Donovan, what files did you change to fix that bug? So we can go back and do some, what are they trying to do? They're trying to do test impact analysis. How do I know? I fixed that bug like a month ago, and you want me to tell you what files I changed a month ago to fix this bug? I have no clue. But if you use TFS and VSO, we can actually link the two together for you forever so that when I check in my code that fixes that bug, I can go to the bug, and it will tell me all the lines of code I changed to fix it. And I never have to remember that stuff for my QA lead. So it's really powerful, the type of integration that we actually have. So let's go back and look at our release one more time and see how it's progressing. I think I've talked long enough for it to get past the load test. So 13 minutes ago, we were in here. And where are we? We're on 4 of 5, which I think actually is the load test. So let's go see. I don't want to look at my artifacts. Sorry. I'm going to look at my logs. And yeah, we are actually, we're basically running our load test right now. So if I were to go already and start looking at my QA environment, what it should look like now is you should have, for example, cool, some other people are playing here, Chrome E user. That, again, is Selenium waking up on my agent, firing up the Chrome browser this time instead of Firefox, and testing my application in QA to make sure that it was going to the right place. What's really nice is I did not have to record my Selenium test three times. I only recorded it once, but I'm able to pass in the URL that I want you to start your testing from. So I can reuse it to point at any different environments that I want, as long as I expect the workflow to be exactly the same. I will write a very nice blog post on exactly how to do that, because every time I've done that, it's taken me a little longer to remember how I did it than I like. But a very, very quick, let's go back to, I think I have my other one open. And I can just show you, give you a highlight so you can actually start investigating that on your own as well. Because it took a little bit of getting to, a little figuring out to get that to work the way I wanted it to. First thing you're going to need is you're going to need what we call a run settings file. The run settings file allows you to define variables that you want to be able to override during your test execution. And as you can see, the URL is one of them, and the browser that I want you to use is the other. That's why I'm able to run Firefox at one point and then Chrome at another point without having to rewrite my test at all. And then if you go and you look at the tests themselves, they're written to be able to read in that different information. So on test initialize, I read those properties, and I determine what browser I need to fire up and what URL you want me to actually use here. And during my release pipeline is where I'm able to pass in overriding values for my web and my browser. So my agent is able to tell you, hey, when you fire up, make sure you use these values and not the other values as well. Now, that's what I wanted to show you from a... All we have to do now is we go back, it's going to say our load test was good. Let's go back and verify that real quick. Yep, it's now waiting for an approval to production. But before I go to production, what I want to do is make sure my load test did look good. So now I can come over here and go to my load test manager. And I can actually look at all the load tests that have been run against my website and actually download and review that information and see exactly how my website is performing in QA. Right? So I was no longer wondering if we're going to get the capacity. Did that new feature that we just add slow us down or speed us up? We'll be able to analyze that using a load test as part of our deployment and then use this before I approve or reject a particular deployment. Okay? So use all of the tools that you have at your disposal to make sure that what you're pushing into production is high quality code. And if I were to go back one more time to our build, we should see now attached to our build is even more test results because I ran additional tests when I was inside. So this was three a moment ago, but this here is the execution of the Chrome browser against my website as well. Right, so it's really nice to be able to look at the build and know the health of the build across the entire deployment. Okay. The only other thing I have to do now is go ahead and push it one more time should I want to. And it would basically go to production, but we've rinsed and repeat that. So that is the demo from end to end. Again, it happened so quickly. If I had not shown you the bouncing ball, I don't think you would have realized all that's happening in the background to actually make what looks very, very simple. It's actually a very complicated scenario. But what's brilliant is I was able to do it. Right? And what made it difficult for me was that I did not know Docker before I started this. I'll tell you a secret. I really, really wanted to speak here. Right? This is like on my speaker's bucket list to get to New Zealand to speak. So when I wrote the abstract for my talk, I threw in everything plus the kitchen sink, right? I'm going to do ASP.NET 5. I'm going to do Docker. It's going to be on Linux and Azure. Yeah, whatever. They'll never accept this. Donovan, you've been accepted for Ignite. I'm like, holy crap. Now I actually have to learn how to do all this stuff, right? So yeah, 2 weeks of my life. My girlfriend, yeah. Thank you. My girlfriend is so glad this is over because I have been a zombie for 2 weeks learning how to do Docker, understanding what Docker Hub meant. I mean, I literally had to learn these concepts. ASP.NET, it's in preview, and guys, it feels like it's in preview, right? I learned a lot of cool stuff, but when I was done, I was like, I was able to do that with all this stuff that I didn't even know how to do a moment ago because this tool set is so flexible, it lets me do whatever I want. So thank you very much for that. And now what we're going to do is we're going to talk about, this is something that I did at Ignite North America that was very, very well received. So I thought I'd give you some of that here too in the last 17 minutes together. Is I've been spending a lot of time with release management. And I've learned a lot of lessons on things to do and things not to do with release management. I just wanted to share some of those with you. So if you guys are trying to build a DevOps pipeline, these are things no matter what tool you're probably using, you're going to want to look out for. These slides are available, and I'm going to update them as well because I think I just made a couple minor modifications to it since I uploaded them. But they have links to different blog posts of my own and other colleagues of mine that explain these ideas in more detail. I said this in the last session, and I'll say it again. If you can show me a command line, I can do it in our build, and I can do it in our release. It is the single most important thing for you to remember if you leave this room. You're going to be wondering, I forgot to ask him about deploying BizTalk. I wonder if I can do that. And my answer to you is, can you show me a command line, a PowerShell, a DSC script? Can you show me something that I can do from a command line that will install BizTalk? Can I do it headless as an MSI and just pass you in the parameters and it install? If the answer is yes, then the answer is yes. I don't care what the technology is. I don't care what the tool is. Just show me a command line, and I'll show you how we can do it in our build and in our release. Most important thing to remember. And there's a lot of cool stuff here on how to report errors back in your PowerShell and things like this. A lot of this is applicable to our current release system. I'm showing you release management. You're some of the first people to actually get to see it. We're targeting the end of the year for what I saw you. That's all web-based. We actually do have release management already. Right? A lot of people don't know that. But we have it. It's part of 2013. And you can actually start using it. And it works quite well. I know this is a big Octopus family. And we're fans of Octopus as well. We know how good that they are. And we integrate with them as well. Right? They actually have a task that they wrote themselves that will show up inside of our toolbox. Right? So we don't hate them at all. We're actually big fans of their stuff and their work. Cross-domain. A lot of people have difficulties when their deployment system is in one domain and where they want to deploy is somewhere else, right? We used to do shadow accounts and all these kind of hunky stuff that we could do to try to make it work. But now, because our agents can be installed anywhere, you can literally install the agent inside your firewall or inside your domain and just register it with us, and then we will be able to have him do whatever we want him to do inside your domain or on your machines for us, right? So it's really nice to be able to put the agent where you need it so that we can reach whatever assets or resources you need us to reach. So you don't have to worry about the hokey shadow accounts and things like that as well. Setting build quality. This goes back to my same mantra. I get questions on Twitter quite a bit, and that is probably the best way to get a hold of me. I'm not trying to get my numbers up, but it's honest. I check that more regularly than my email. So someone asked me this question once. It was kind of neat. So he said, Donovan, the build quality, every build that I just produced has a quality that you can assign to it, ready for QA testing, passed initial testing, released, whatever the case might be. And he says, I want to control that value as it's moving through the pipeline. I don't want to have to remember to go back and set that. Well, everything that you can do to Team Foundation Server can be done through an API. We're moving it to REST, but today you can do it by just simply adding an assembly to your project and then writing to the API as your heart's consent. You can also do it from PowerShell. In PowerShell, I can say, please go load that DLL, and now inside that DLL, I have access to everything. So what I did is I wrote a PowerShell script that would allow me to change the build quality of any build that I wanted to at any time that I wanted to. And I shared that with this person, and he says, great, now what I can do is during my release, I simply call the PowerShell with the desired quality of the build that I want it to be set. During my release, I don't have to remember. So the last thing he does in production is set the build quality to released, and he never has to touch it himself. What was really cool about this one is I did this in North America, and the guy who sent me the tweet was actually in the audience. He was so excited, right? He came up after me and said, that was my question that you answered and you showed on stage. So I really do listen to the guys who tweet at me, and I go back in and I solve them because they make for really good blog posts for me. right? So you ask me a question, I usually will blog the answer, right? So that everyone can share in the answer. Build quality is one of them. Retain indefinitely was another one. Historically, I don't know if it's doing it now in the current preview, but historically what we would do is we would set the retain indefinitely flag on any build that release management touched, regardless if it was released or not. That has pluses and minuses. Plus is, if I ever need that build, it's there. The minus is, that build is always there, which means my hard drive starts to fill up with all these builds that never saw the light of day but had this flag set. In our old system, we have the ability to trigger a rollback should something bad happen. So what I did is I wrote a PowerShell script, loaded the same DLLs I did before, allowed you to find the build that we were actually trying to deploy with release management, and return that flag to not being retained indefinitely. They put this call inside of a rollback sequence. So essentially, once the release said, I'm giving up, this isn't going to work, I'm going to roll all this stuff back, the last thing it did is it flipped this switch again so that this build could safely be deleted because we didn't deploy it anyway. Right? So again, think outside of the box. Anything I can do from a command line, I can do in our build. One of our customers internally, because we dog food this, one of my favorite quotes of all time from Satya is at TR19, he said that we need to stop living this fake life where we write software for others that we would not use ourselves. He was talking about TFS and VSO because Word and Office was not using TFS. Windows was not using TFS. Yet we expected you guys to use it instead. We now use TFS internally, right, for all those products. So we actually do this stuff. Release management is another one that we use internally. One of the customers internally said, Donovan, we want to use release management, but we already store all of our secrets in another CMDB. We don't want to have to take all that data out of that CMDB and transfer it over into release management to start using it for a deployment. I was like, well, how did you guys solve this? Is what we did is because we can do whatever we want from a command line, we exposed a REST API of our CMDB, and then we called that from release management to go query the information and the secrets that we needed to, and then we used it in the PowerShell as it was running inside of release management. Blew my mind. I was like, man, I've been doing some cool stuff for release management, but I would have never thought to do that. So it doesn't matter if it's an external resource that you need, an internal resource that you've written, is if you can show me a command line, we can actually access it from release management. That was one of the coolest things I'd actually ever seen with it as well. Resource manager is another one, resource groups at the bottom. That allows us to do infrastructure as code, where we can actually spin up any of these resources we want, be it PaaS, IaaS, or SaaS. Infrastructure, platform, or software as a service is what those stand for. Basically, it's VMs, stuff you don't have to install, and the world's greatest thing, which is PaaS. If you guys are lifting and shifting to Azure, that's great. Getting out of your data center and getting onto ours, do not get comfortable in IaaS. That's my only advice to you. Figure out ways to get to PaaS as quickly as you possibly can, right? Meeting your SLA is much easier. Scaling it is much easier. Just all the cool stuff that comes from the cloud actually happens at PaaS. IaaS, it's just a box you own in the cloud, right? You are responsible for putting the hot fixes on it. You're responsible for the everything on it, right? It's like buying a car versus PaaS is like renting a car. And you know how bad we are on rental cars, right? Do whatever you want to it, and we have to guarantee that that thing keeps running for you, right? It's really, really cool. That's the one I use. I use PaaS. I've gone through moving from IaaS to PaaS. I was in GoDaddy, and one of the hard drives on my server there crashed. And I'm calling them like, dude, what are you guys going to do to help me? They're like, nothing. It's your server. I don't know what happened to your hard drive, but my site's down now for half an hour as I panic to find a backup and try to restore everything that was going on. So then I moved to PaaS, and I sleep well at night, right? Because it's going to be up, and if not, they're going to pay me for it not being up, right? So again, IaaS is great, PaaS is better. Deployment slots. If you're using Azure today, there's this cool thing called web apps that basically is just a virtual directory. Don't worry about the server underneath. We'll take care of that. It's just your own virtual directory. Now, this virtual directory can be broken down into things called deployment slots. And a slot is almost like a mirror image of your web app with its own custom configuration. So what I can do here is really cool, and I do this on dobracing.com, is every time I check in code, it builds and it deploys to the staging slot every single time, right? So it's continuous deployment to the staging slot. But the staging slot's not seen by any of my customers. I go out there and I test it, I poke at it, I make sure the new feature works the way that I want it to. And when I'm happy, I have an approval inside of my workflow that just swaps the slots. Literally, instantly, it takes the VIP, the VIP, from one and changes it to the other. My customers have no idea I've done this. I've done 5 of these in one day before, right? Deployed 5 times to the same site. No one had, it was zero downtime. because you deploy to the slot, and then you swap the slots when you're happy. We can also use the slots for A-B testing. Instead of swapping 100% of the traffic from one slot to the other, I can route 10% of the traffic to one, 90% to the other, see how that 10% react to the change. If they like it, great, I swap the rest of them over. If they don't like it, I've only upset 10%, and I go right back to where I was before using deployment slots as well. So we can implement those across release management. Some things you have to remember is you don't swap across environments. The first time I saw deployment slots, I said, this is awesome. I'm going to have a dev slot, a QA slot, and a prod slot, and I'm just going to swap my way into production. Right? It sounds like that's what you would do. But what happens when you need to, when you do a release pipeline, what you do in a particular pipeline, you can restart that should something bad happen. So what happens when I swapped into production what I want, but something, the test failed? So I restart it. What am I about to do? Swap what was in production right back out again, right? So I'm literally fighting against myself. So you never swap across across environments. What you would do when you want to use deployment slots is in my dev environment, I would have a staging slot and the live slot, okay? And then in my QA environment, I would duplicate that. I'd have a staging slot and the live slot all the way into production. So if I were to restart it, what I would first do is copy into the staging slot the bits I actually want, and then swap it into production. And if I restarted that, the end result is exactly the same. Take the files I want, put them in staging, and swap them again. That way I can test the swapping technology and make sure that by the time I get to production, it's going to work the way that I want it to, but I have the ability to restart should I have to, right? So just be careful when you're using them. And also think about your database changes. If I've made database changes, and I swap a version of my website out that expects a column to be there, something bad were to happen, and I swap them back, the database doesn't swap with your web app. There's still a column in that database now for middle name, and if your application doesn't expect it or for some reason chokes, then you swapping back all of a sudden doesn't work, right? You're in worse shape than you were if you'd have just left the other side up. So make sure that when you're making database changes, you think about that. What people are doing now is they're making sure that their database changes are at least one version backwards compatible. That if I have to swap back instantly for whatever reason, the database will still support the app in which it's running. So if I need to delete a column of my database, I can only delete it two versions from now. When if I needed to swap back, that version still didn't expect that column to be there. Does that make sense to everyone? All right, so that's a really, really important one. Deployment slots are really great, and a lot of us went out and started using them and started shooting ourselves in the foot. SSDT, I've already kind of preached this story here. This is extremely powerful, powerful stuff. I really am a big fan of it. I actually have an hour-long demo that I do just on this tool set. Right, it's that powerful of stuff. So big fan of SSDT. If you're doing anything with SQL Server, including SQL Server out in Azure, I highly recommend that you look at this. And then finally, what I want to show you guys is this slide again from the last one. So if you didn't get a picture of this one last time, you can go ahead and take a picture of it again. It's a very, very popular slide. And it allows me to say what I'm about to say. Microsoft is uniquely positioned as the only vendor on the planet that has everything that you need. You might find someone who has a great work item tracking or agile planning, but I bet you they don't have a cloud. You might find someone who has great version control, but they don't have automated build. You might find someone who has X or someone else who has Y, but no one has A through Z except us here at Microsoft. If you want one vendor that you can use that takes you from ideation to monitoring it in production, there is only one vendor that you can actually go to, and that is us. Cool thing about Microsoft, or what I would say the new Microsoft is, any piece of that that you want to replace with someone else's product, we're giving you the hooks to do that as well. Right? As much as I'd love you to use all of it, and I think it's best used together because it automatically talks to each other out of the box, you're not forced to use our build system if you like Jenkins better. But you can still leverage our release management system even if you're using Jenkins. Right? So let's make sure you think about that. I would encourage you to evaluate the entire system end to end. Have your TSP or SSP set up a demo for your company that shows you the greatness that is Microsoft. And if you're still not sold that our work item tracking is better than someone else's, then continue to use theirs, but use the rest of it that you see value in. Okay? So other than that, I think we are, there's only one other thing that comes after mine that I was thought would be applicable to what we're doing. Azure Resource Manager, which again is the infrastructure as code portion of our DevOps story here. And I have about 3 minutes now that I can actually answer some questions. But before I do, I just want to say one more time, it has been an honor to come to New Zealand and speak to you guys. And if you would like to have me back, please make sure you fill out your evals and tell them so that I can come back next year and talk to you guys. Thanks, guys.